Our reading is from Romans chapter 5. Before Christmas, we followed a series of studies in the earlier chapters of Romans, and now over the next few weeks, we shall be having four more studies in the central chapters of Romans. You'll find the details on the program card, the folded card that's on your seat this morning. Do take that away with you. Then you can read the passage ahead of time if you'd like to do that. So we're going to read from Romans chapter 5, verse 12, through to the end of the chapter. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all men, because all sinned. For before the law was given, sin was in the world, but sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam, who was a pattern of the one to come. But the gift is not like the trespass. For if the many died by the trespass of the one man, how much more did God's grace and the gift that came by the grace of the one man, Jesus Christ, overflow to the many? Again, the gift of God is not like the result of the one man's sin. The judgment followed one sin and brought condemnation. But the gift followed many trespasses and brought justification. For if by the trespass of the one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and of the gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ? Consequently, just as the result of one trespass was condemnation for all men, so also the result of one act of righteousness was justification that brings life for all men. For just as through the disobedience of the one man the many were made sinners, so also through the obedience of the one man the many will be made righteous. The law was added so that the trespass might increase. But where sin increased, grace increased all the more. So that just as sin reigned in death, so also grace might reign through righteousness to bring eternal life through Jesus Christ, our Lord. There are some problems in this world, aren't there, which go so deep, they just don't admit to superficial solutions. Every farmer knows that. There are some plant diseases that just can't be eradicated with a fungicidal spray or something like that. The only answer is to burn the field and to replant the crop afresh. Every doctor knows it too. There are some physical injuries that you just can't repair with elastoplast. They need radical surgery or perhaps even an organ transplant in the extreme. I suspect every politician knows it too. Some dictators just do not yield to diplomacy. They can only be overcome by some kind of force, by some kind of pressure of a more obvious kind. They have to be replaced. You can't deal with them. The Bible would have us know that in God's eyes, our whole world presents that sort of intractable problem. A bit like a weed-ridden garden. The tares of wickedness have been sown in our world, and there's no easy way to uproot them. Or a bit like a case of some dreadful disease, like leprosy, maybe. The moral image of God has been marred in us human beings. And it can't be restored just by cosmetics. Or even like, say, Nazi Germany or Stalinist Russia. Mankind, according to the Bible, has fallen under the tyranny of evil. And there is no possibility of negotiating our way back to freedom again. We are helplessly in the grip of that power of evil. That is the scale of our plight. That's the depth of our problem. It admits of no glib or easy solutions, you see. As we were saying earlier, many of us, I guess, have made a few private, if not public, New Year's resolutions, as we do every January the 1st. And every year, of course, we break them, don't we? Why do we do that? Why is our record so habitually disappointing? Well, that's just one manifestation of this problem. We are part of a fallen world. And our world doesn't just need to turn over a new leaf. Indeed, it can't turn over a new leaf, even if it wants to. What our world needs is a much more radical new beginning than that. The reason, according to the Bible, is that it was at the beginning, the very first beginning, at the very origin of our human history, that the problem also began. It was then at the beginning that these invasive weeds took root. It was then at the beginning that this disfiguring infection was transmitted. It was then at the beginning that this vicious tyrant seized power. That's when the problem began, at the beginning. So if there's to be any hope for us human beings, a remedy for our plight must be found, which is equally radical. And that's why the Bible speaks, you see, of a new birth. You must be born again, says Jesus. Nothing less radical, no beginning less new than that will suffice. That's why the Bible speaks of a new creation. I'm going to make a new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness will be at home, says God through the prophet. And that's why here in Romans 5, our study passage this morning, we find the Apostle Paul speaking about a new humanity. Now, if I'm going to be honest with you, I have to say this is a difficult passage. In fact, I imagine as we were just reading it a moment or so ago, some of you found it difficult, even just listening to it read. It's been the occasion of an enormous amount of debate over the years. And if I'm going to be true to the passage, I can't spare you some discussion of those arguments. But this is also an enormously important passage. A passage of huge significance in this letter to the Romans that we've been studying. You see, up until this point, those of you who've been following these series of studies will remember, I hope, Paul has been explaining to us how it is that those of us who are Christians come to enjoy peace with God as a result of our faith, our trust in Jesus Christ. To use Paul's own vocabulary, he's been unfolding to us his doctrine of justification by faith. Remember, those were the words that have occurred so often. Justification by faith. But in these closing verses of chapter 5, he's bringing that discussion to a conclusion. He's about to embark on a new major phase of his discussion, which we shall start looking at next week. That opening word, therefore, of verse 12, makes it plain that what he's about to say is very much tying together his previous lines of thought. And it not so much looks forward just to the preceding verse as, I think, to the whole preceding four chapters. Paul's drawing all the threads of our earlier studies together in these closing verses of chapter 5. But as he does that, he doesn't merely summarize those earlier arguments. He also injects a startling new dimension. See, he's saying here that personal experience which Christians enjoy of forgiveness of sins, that is not to be viewed, he's saying, as just some private psychological or emotional or spiritual healing. It's not to be viewed individualistically. No, he says, that experience of justification by faith that I've been talking about is just a part of a momentous transformation of quite literally cosmic proportions, a transformation that embraces not just you and me, but the whole human race. That's why you'll notice that whereas in the earlier part of chapter 5, Paul uses the first-person pronouns all the time, we and us. He's talking very intimately with his Christian brothers at Rome. But here in these later verses, he speaks repeatedly about the many and all men. For here Paul is going beyond the narrow confines of the experience of the individual Christian or even of a local church. Here he's placing his doctrine of justification by faith against the panoramic backcloth of the whole sweep of human history. But what we're talking about, he says, in this justification by faith business, is not just me personally getting right with God. We're talking about a new age, a new beginning, a new humanity. So difficult as the passage may be, it's also a particularly thrilling passage, a particularly exciting passage, once you get a handle on what Paul is talking about. It unfolds to us, on the one hand, the frightening depth of our human problem. Just how serious the human plight is, how deep it goes, how far back it goes. But it also unfolds the even greater dimensions of the divine solution, the salvation which God in his grace and his generosity has provided for you and me. Well, let's try and unravel a bit of this difficult passage then, with that in mind. To make Paul's argument just a little bit easier, let's focus down initially on just those opening three verses, verses 12 to 14. Look at them again with me. Therefore, just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin, and in this way death came to all men, because all sinned. For before the law was given, sin was in the world, but sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam. Paul here then is introducing a subject which he hasn't spoken about a great deal in earlier verses. He's introducing the subject of death. I suppose there's nothing which epitomizes the despair of our human condition more obviously than that subject, death. Death is the universal, inescapable kind of fact of our existence, isn't it? They will give you odds on practically anything at Ladbrokes, practically anything you can bet on in this country. But you'll never find a bookie prepared to give you odds on immortality. That's why, of course, you shouldn't strictly speak of life insurance. You know that, don't you? People do, but they shouldn't. It's a misnomer. You should really speak of life assurance. Because technically, you can only insure against an unwelcome possibility. But every insurance agent knows death is not a mere possibility. It's a statistical certainty. You can't insure against death. You can only provide some assurance for your family when it happens. Because happen it will. Yet in spite of its inevitability, it's strange, isn't it, that we have never really come to terms with death. Death is such a horrible intrusion in our experience. We fear death, if we're honest, don't we? Like Woody Allen says, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be around when it happens. And when it happens to somebody close to us, we resent death, don't we? I remember very clearly an atheist friend of mine who, if you asked him, as I frequently had done, would have told you, we are just a highly evolved animal, we human beings. We are just destined to decompose into our constituent atoms like dogs do. Once the second law of thermodynamics claims us, our body chemistry disintegrates, that's all we really are. And yet I remember how he was strangely disturbed by the funeral of a friend. He told me he felt cheated by that death. He found himself demanding even, why did it happen? People always do. Death is always an incongruous intrusion into our experience that we fear and resent. Why is that so? Well, Paul is telling us here. He's giving us the answer to it. Ironically, it's an answer which has to do with something which my evolutionist atheistic friend found very difficult to believe ever existed. It has to do with a man called Adam. just as sin entered the world through one man, that is Adam, and death through sin, in this way death came to all men, because all sinned. So we learn three things there, don't we? First of all, Paul is saying, death is foreign to us human beings. It isn't original. It entered, to use his word, it entered our world at a particular moment in history. Now that, of course, explains a great deal. It explains our discomfort in the face of death, doesn't it? There is something incongruous, something unnatural about death. Deep down in our hearts, we know with some kind of primeval intuition that we are not intended to die. Death is alien to us human beings. Animals may accept death, but we don't. I guess that's why death in our affluent West has become such a profitable commercial enterprise. Funeral directors know that we are prepared to spend almost any amount of money to be spared the brutality of death. So let them beautify it with cosmetics, or glamorize it with flowers, or romanticize it with sentimental music for us. Death is something we do not want to seriously face. It's something we want to hide from. Disguise it in an atmosphere of very refined and very expensive unreality, we say. For we have an intuition that there is something ugly and perverse about death which we do not want to accept. Well, no wonder, says Paul. We were not meant to die. Death is, as you deep down feel it is, an alien invader. We are right to rebel against it. We're right to shake our fist at it. For it doesn't belong to our race. God, when he made this world, put eternity into the human heart. And our anguish in the face of death is nothing but the consequence of that frustrated aspiration for eternity. It's the first thing we learn from this passage, that death is foreign to our human nature. Then we learn a second thing, don't we? Right at the very outset from this first verse. We learn that there is a close connection between death and sin. Just as sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin. Now, Paul then is implying that the reason we die is the consequence of our human moral failure. Death entered the world as a consequence of the entry of moral failure into the world. Of course, in saying that, he's echoing what the Bible's teaching generally. He's echoing the early chapters of Genesis. In the day you eat of that forbidden tree, you shall die, God had said to Adam. That's what's in Paul's mind as he says that. And even for those of us who don't have his background in the Old Testament scriptures, it doesn't come as a complete surprise to hear that connection between death and sin, does it? I mean, in human society generally, when we find a man who is guilty of some very serious crime, we often say, he deserves to die. We talk about the death penalty. Just as we have an intuition that death is foreign to us, we also have this kind of instinct in us. But if death happens, especially if it happens prematurely, especially if it happens unexpectedly, then the person must have done something to deserve it, or else it's unfair. In many cultures, when somebody dies in such circumstances, they look around for some circumstance to blame. There's a certain superstitiousness about it, maybe, yet it's an understandable superstition. For all of us, when we're faced with unexpected, premature death especially, rebel against it. It ought not to have happened, we say. He didn't deserve it. That's the problem with what Paul says here, of course. Death entered through sin. All right, we can believe that. But the logic of retribution doesn't always work, does it? Good men die young. Sometimes. Sometimes even tiny children die who don't even know the difference between right and wrong. How can this connection then between sin and death work? If human death is the consequence of human sin, as the Bible insists, how does it work? The correlation doesn't fit. That's why we get angry. And that, of course, brings us to the third and the most difficult thing Paul is teaching in this opening verse. Death is foreign to us. There is a connection between death and sin. And thirdly, all human beings die, but as a result of one man's sin. That's what he's saying. Just as sin entered the world through one man and death through sin, and in this way, death came to all men. Paul Tillich, the theologian, tells a moving story in one of his sermons. It's a story that was actually recorded at the Nuremberg trials at the end of the Second World War. A Polish Jew told in testimony at those trials how he had hidden from the Nazi gas chambers in a graveyard. And while he was there, a young woman, also in hiding, gave birth to a baby. The only place she could have this baby, be delivered of this child, was in a freshly dug grave in that cemetery. And the only clothing they could find to wrap the child in was a shroud. In 3 days, the child was dead because its undernourished mother had no milk for it. Very moving story. But Tillich says it's a kind of a parable of the tragedy, not just of that wartime horror, but of the plight of the human race as a whole. According to the apostle here, we are all of us born in a grave. We are born dying. According to the apostle here, we do not have to sin personally and actively in order to become victim to this death penalty for sin. We're already victim to it, right from the moment of our birth. We share in some way the consequences of Adam's sin. Death is part of our human inheritance. It entered the world through that one man, that one original man, and now we are all victim to it. Now, of course, this is a pretty outrageous thing to say. It's met with huge objections on all hands. Uninformed people profess to find the whole idea of such a kind of universal linkage to one progenitor, to Adam, scientifically objectionable. How can anybody expect you to believe that? They're all the descendants of one man, they say. How can all of us, black, brown, yellow, and white, be part of the same human family? It's impossible, they say. But actually, of course, it's not impossible at all. Anthropologists don't have any problem with that idea. The diversity we observe in mankind is quite literally only skin deep. Every animal breeder knows that it takes remarkably few generations of selective breeding to fix a superficial characteristic like color into a variety of cow or dog. Yeah, the significant thing about us human beings are the things we have in common under our skin. Those are things that matter, our physiology, our blood groups. Perhaps from the biological point of view, most significant of all, the fact that we are interfertile. The simplest explanation of these observations is that the human race is one species, Homo sapiens. And that implies, of course, that we share a common parentage. That we derive, as a biologist might say, from a single original gene pool. The Bible just goes a little further than the evolutionist might want to go, by saying we didn't just emerge from a single gene pool, we emerged from a single original pair. There's nothing essentially unscientific or unbelievable about that claim. only the ignorant would try to pretend there was. Indeed, to deny the Bible's assertion of the genetic unity of the human race, of course, is to open the door very quickly to racism. If you don't believe we're all derived from one family, what do you believe about the different races of humankind, then? Michael Jackson tells us very emphatically in his latest album, it doesn't matter if you're black or white. Paul would agree. In fact, in his day, he would have put it slightly differently. He would have said, it doesn't matter whether you're Jew or Gentile, for that was the issue for him. Why doesn't it matter? Paul says here, it fundamentally doesn't matter because we human beings are at root brothers and sisters. We are part of a single family, the family of Adam, and we have one big problem in common, therefore. None of us have special advantages over the other because of our racial origins. No, on the contrary, our racial origin is our problem. Our racial origin in Adam, that is. Now, the real difficulty, which I think a modern man or woman experiences in reading Romans 5, is not that it collides with our scientific views so much. Rather, it's because it collides with our philosophy. We don't like the idea of inheriting guilt and guilt's penalty. That seems so very unfair to modern men and women, doesn't it? It contradicts the egalitarianism of the 20th century, for instance. Socialists tell us everybody must have a fair chance. All inheritance is unjust. It's not fair for a person to be blessed by their father's wealth or to be cursed by their father's poverty, says the socialist. Yet Paul is arguing here that we do have such an inheritance, that the sin and death which Adam incurred has been passed on to his descendants, whether we like it or not. That's what he's saying. What's more, it contradicts the individualism of our 20th century ideas. For capitalism, of course, tells us men and women should get what they deserve. It says nobody should be handicapped in life by the free choices of others. They should be able to make free choices for themselves. But Paul is telling us here, we are hopelessly handicapped and our freedom limited by the choice of our forebear, by Adam's choice. We die as a result of his sin, ultimately. Neither socialist egalitarianism then, or capitalist individualism, can make much sense of the moral economics of Romans 5. They're very offensive to the modern mind. How can I be justly penalized for somebody else's sin? Why should I die? Because Adam did. It's monstrously unjust, we say. How can you suggest such a thing, Paul? And yet it's not surprising that even Christian theologians have tried very hard to interpret Paul's words here in Romans 5 in some less objectionable way, to ease the embarrassment of what Paul seems to be saying here. Some, for instance, suggest that Paul is arguing mythologically. They say Adam simply represents each individual human being. We each personally sin as Adam is supposed to have sinned. And so we each personally receive the penalty for our own fall. Adam's a kind of mythological symbol for every man. Well, I don't want to get into an argument with anybody this morning about whether you believe in a literal Adam or Eve or not, but what I'm sure about is that Paul believed in a literal Adam and speaks here not about myth, but about history. Sin entered the world, he says. He's clearly thinking of a time in history when it began. He even speaks of the period of time between Adam and Moses. It's quite clear that Paul isn't thinking mythologically, even if some theologians do. Another suggestion that's often mooted is that what Adam has passed on to us, his descendants, is not an inheritance of actual guilt, but simply of moral weakness. A tendency to sin. deriving perhaps from genetic or environmental factors. As a result of this, every person recapitulates Adam's sin in their own action because of this inherited tendency to sin. Many people have argued like that. Like father, like son. Well, that may be part of what Paul has in mind. He certainly does believe that as a result of the fall of the human race, all of us have a tendency to sin. He has a word to describe that tendency. Flesh, often translated the sinful nature in our translation here, the NIV. And he'll be using that word, sinful nature, a lot in the chapters that follow. We shall hear a lot about it in coming weeks. You can even claim some support from the text for this view. Looking again at verse 12, you notice the way he says it. Death came to all men because all sinned. Not because Adam sinned, but because all sinned. So we're not just passive recipients of this inheritance of sin and death. We're actively involved in the sinning. Paul is clear about that. But the question, of course, is, does Paul mean simply that everybody copies Adam's original sin? Or that in some collective way we're involved in Adam's original sin? You can take the passage both ways. And I think there's quite strong evidence for the fact that Paul does mean, at least partly, the latter, that we are actually involved in Adam's sinning. Not just that we copy it, not just that we recapitulate it. One thing that argues in favor of that is the tense of that verb sinned there in verse 12, which speaks of an action which is complete at a single point in the past. If Paul was thinking of a continuing habit of sin in the human race, he would have much more naturally have used the imperfect tense. He would have said, in this way death came to all men because all men went on sinning. But that isn't what he says. He says all men sinned once, complete in the past, as if he's referring to that primeval sin of Adam. And indeed, the way he goes on to argue in verses 13 and 14 supports that understanding of his meaning. For he says, before the law was given, sin was in the world. But sin is not taken into account when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from the time of Adam to the time of Moses, even over those who did not sin by breaking a command, as did Adam. Paul here is pointing to that historical period between the origin of man and the time of Moses. He points out that during that time, there was no revealed moral law for human beings to break. They only had the light of conscience. So during that time, you could argue, I suppose, that God ought to take a more lenient view of human sin. Surely sin can't be defined properly or counted when there's no clear law. I mean, how can you blame somebody for doing what he doesn't know is wrong, you could argue. Lawyers may tell us ignorance of the law is no excuse, but then they've got a vested interest in such a dogma, haven't they? Common sense tells you that ignorance of the law is an excuse. People then who lived between Adam and Moses did not sin in the same way Adam did, because they were not transgressing, to use Paul's words. They weren't disobeying a direct commandment of God, which they'd had explicitly given to them. Yes, says Paul. What do we find? You look back at those lists, those vast genealogies in the early chapters of Genesis. How do they read? Cain and Abel and Methuselah and Lamech and all those people. What do we read about them? The story is always the same. They lived so many years. They had so many children. Then they died. They did so many years. They had so many children. And then they died. They died. They died. They died. Nevertheless, comments Paul, death reigned, even over those who had not sinned like Adam. What conclusion can we draw from that? Why, says Paul, it's obvious as it is controversial. As a result of that original disobedience, all of Adam's descendants had become subject to the same moral bondage and to the same death penalty as their forefather. They didn't have to sin in the same direct and rebellious fashion Adam did. They were born out of paradise. They were born in a grave. We could multiply the same kinds of examples from our contemporary world, couldn't we? People often ask about the unevangelized who live still in the jungle or children below the age of discretion. These too are subject to death. Yet how can that be if death is the penalty for our sin? Why? The Bible would say it's because we are not just sinners by choice, we are sinners by birth. That is our status. Every human being is born dying. It's a frightful thing, isn't it? This is the measure, this is the dimension of our problem. And the question that's haunted scholars, of course, who wrestle with what Paul says here is how he can argue such a thing. How can he really believe it? How is Adam's sin communicated to us? How can God blame us? How does it work? Some people have suggested there's some kind of legal connection between Adam and us, that he's like the federal head. He's our champion. So that we are involved, we are implicated in his sin in some legal way. Others argue, no, Paul must believe in some kind of pre-existence of the human soul. He must believe that all human beings were somehow inside Adam when Adam sinned, and so we were all there when it happened. They say he must be resorting to some kind of superstitious or mythological or eccentric or speculative philosophy to hold this strange idea that all of us are subject to death. Because the original man from whom we're all descended sinned and became subject to death. But I think there's a much easier explanation than that. I don't think we have to suggest that Paul is engaging in some speculation that's remote from anything we understand in what he's saying here. Our problem with understanding Romans 5 is simply that we're coming at it with all the presuppositions of our Western philosophy, with our individualism, and our collectivism, rotating in our minds. So we have forgotten the category of thought which was central to Paul, because Paul was a Jew. We have forgotten family. Paul was a Jew. The primary unit of human identity and affinity for him was family. It's two families he's talking about in this chapter. Two companies of people bound together in racial solidarity. The family, the race of Adam, and the family, or the race of Jesus. Family has lost its significance to us. We've been so atomized by capitalist individualism and so homogenized by socialist collectivism. We don't think in family terms anymore, but in other parts of the globe it isn't so. If you go to Africa or to East Asia, you'll find there that kinship still exercises a powerful influence. One of the most prominent East African theologians some years ago expressed it like this. He said, Western ideas of personality are based on the famous dictum of Descartes, I think, therefore I am. We perceive our existence as rooted in the rationality of the individual mind. But he said, in African consciousness, it would be truer to say, We are related even. Therefore, I am. Human existence in many parts of the world derives from an awareness of family community, an affinity that is immensely close. Every decision is a family decision. Our very existence is rooted in our family identity, our family name. The first things we are taught are our family members going back generations. For that is who we are. Even if you go back in European thought, you find people who understood this, though we have now forgotten it. Like John Donne's famous lines, no man is an island entire of itself. Every man is part of the continent. Don't ask whom the bell tolls for, it tolls for you. It's family that Paul is thinking about here. I mean, you can think about it this way if you like. If my father is a drunkard, I feel ashamed. Why should I do that? Why should I feel ashamed? Because my father's a drunkard. He's the drunkard, not me. But no, you and I know that family doesn't work like that. Even in our Western world, it doesn't work like that. When one member of the family fails in some way, we all feel implicated. We all feel responsible. You can call it irrational, if you like. But it's the way we're made. On the other hand, if my father had been awarded an OBE in the New Year's Honours List this week, then I'd be feeling proud. Why? It's his medal, not mine. But because I'm in his family, I'm part of him. There's an indissoluble relationship of blood that links us. Because of that, I participate in his achievements. I'll take another example. If my father becomes bankrupt, I suffer his poverty in some measure. Of course, it's unfair. All inheritance is unfair, so long as we see family as something arbitrary and unnecessary to human existence. Then all family relationships create unfairness, don't they? It's unfair that Jack should be cleverer than John simply because his father's got a high IQ. It's unfair that a Rachel should be prettier than Fiona just because her mother's beautiful. It's the way we're made, you see. All the bureaucratic meddling of a million social servants will not alter the fact. The family is an essential part of the structure of our human existence. And it's that thought which I suggest to you is really at the heart of what Paul is getting at here when he talks about us sinning and dying in Adam. We human beings are not angels. We were not manufactured like individual works of art. Each one of us derives our existence out of two other human beings called parents, who in turn derive their existence out of other human beings called grandparents, who derive their existence from others called great-grandparents, and so on and so on. And in this way, we are tied together through a kind of organic linkage, a tree. That's what we call it, isn't it? A family tree. And it's that way of thinking about what it means to be a human being, which is at the heart of Paul's thinking when he says, when Adam sinned and incurred the death penalty for sin, we sinned too. And because he died, we died. Is our link to him a legal one? Well, yes, it is a legal one if you want to think of it in that way. He is our father, and children are responsible for the debts of their parents after they die. They inherit the estate. Bankruptcy is included. Is my link to him a real one? Well, yes, it's a real one too, in this sense, that we're genetically related to him. It's no arbitrary arrangement that ties our destiny to Adam. His seed is in us. We belong to his tribe, his race, his family. And that is why our problem is so intractable. If it was just my problem on my own, just possibly I could do something about it. But it isn't. The nature of my problem as a human being is that I am born with it, and I cannot escape from it. Part of my inheritance. Even before I draw a breath, the death penalty is already written over me. Inscribed in the very genetic code of my body. We are slaves, then, to sin and to death, says Paul, from birth. Sin and death tyrannize us. We are the helpless victims of it. There is no answer to such a problem, says Paul. No answer we can find. We're born in this hopeless condition. You see what I mean when I say there are some problems that don't admit of superficial answers? This weed has put down deep roots in our race. This virus has found its way into every bloodstream. This tyrant dominates the universe and will not be dethroned. Unless. Unless, of course, some way can be found whereby you and I can become members of another family. That's exactly what the Apostle Paul is saying has happened here. You and I can become members of the family of Jesus. There's a great irony, of course. The genetic solidarity, which in Adam was our curse, he says, has in Christ become our salvation. There is still hope for us. How? Through the one man. No, not that one man he was talking about just now, Adam. A different one man, Jesus Christ. Verse 17, if by the trespass of the one man death reigned through that one man, how much more will those who receive God's abundant provision of grace and of the gift of righteousness reign in life through that one man, Jesus Christ? There is a new family to join. He had to come, you see, as a real human being. This is the meaning of Christmas. He had to join our race, but he did not share the moral inheritance of Adam. He was uniquely placed to be the progenitor of a new family, a new humanity. And that's what he has done. Is our link to Jesus a legal one? Well, yes, it is. We are adopted into this family. We don't belong there naturally. But God, by a judicial act, places us in relationship to himself as sons and daughters, adopting us into the family of Jesus Christ. Is our relationship to him a real one, though, not just a legal fiction? Certainly it's a real one, because we're indwelt by the Spirit of Jesus, his Son. If you like, God has shared his genes with us in a way no ordinary adoptive parent can possibly share their genes with their children. He has put his seed within us so that the family likeness is actually being reproduced in us. This is the beginning of a new humanity, then. A humanity with an altogether different destiny from that old humanity. For to belong to the humanity of Adam is to be constituted a sinner, says Paul. It is to be made a sinner. It is to have the legal status of a sinner. It is to have the inner corruption of a sinner. And it is to be subject to the sinner's punishment. Death. But to belong to the family of Jesus Christ is to be constituted righteous. It is to have the status of a justified person, a righteous person. It's to have the inner moral renewal of the Holy Spirit. And it is to share the destiny which only the righteous may know. Life eternal. Those who belong to the family of Jesus Christ, he says, will reign in life through that one man who is their hero, their elder brother, Jesus Christ. I want to invite you to join a new family then this morning. Do you notice the word Paul uses again and again about this whole situation? He calls it grace, doesn't it? Again and again he talks about God's grace overflowing to the many. God's abundant provision of grace. Grace increasing all the more. In verse 21 he even speaks about grace reigning. Why does he say that? It's because he wants us to understand that though we are in the family of Adam by nature, we don't have to do anything to be in that family. To join the family of Jesus Christ is a gift. It's something God bestows freely out of the generosity of his heart. And of course, a gift has to be received, doesn't it? When he speaks of the many here, he doesn't mean everybody without distinction in the world. This gift of a new family in Jesus Christ is for those who receive the gift. To them he gave the authority to be called the children of God. That is, to as many as received him and believed in his name. Paul doesn't want us to leave this passage feeling perplexed. he wants us to leave this passage feeling grateful. If any of you watch Ben-Hur over Christmas, I noticed it was on yet again. There's that marvellous section of it, isn't there, where Judah Ben-Hur, after finding himself enslaved in a Roman galley and doomed, it seems, to the early death which all such galley slaves were victim to, by a miraculous providence, he develops a relationship with Arius, the Roman admiral who commands the galley. And eventually this noble Roman adopts him as his own son. So from a situation of total hopelessness, Ben-Hur's fortunes are dramatically reversed. From being a slave, he becomes a citizen, a person of dignity and of hope. What an extraordinary thing! If Ben-Hur, standing there as Arius says, "I want to call this man my son and adopt him into my family," has said, "No, thank you very much. I prefer to live in a galley as a slave. Do you want to be a member of Jesus' family? That's the challenge that emerges, you see, from our passage. Our membership in the tribe of Adam is automatic, but our membership in the family of Jesus is something God offers us this morning. We never ask to be a member of Adam's family, but you must ask if you want to be a member of Jesus' family. It is a gift. He holds out his hand. "Look, I'm willing to call you my brother." God is willing to adopt you, spiritual pauper though you are. Join the new humanity, which I am building out of the wreck, the ruin of Adam's race. Righteousness and eternal life are there, if you will. Condemnation and death are your inheritance, if you will not. See, from now on, now that Jesus has come, if we perish, we can no longer complain that it's all the fault of Adam. Even if there was some travesty of truth in such a complaint, it's true no longer. No, from now on, if you and I perish, it's because we have refused the gift of God's new humanity. Isn't it? Let's pray together.